Outlet Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome along to today's edition of The Profile with me, Justin Briley. And my guest today is Dr. Simon Stewart, the new Executive Director of Arusha International. And don't forget, if you'd like more interviews with Christians in all walks of life, you can find them in the magazine that promotes this particular program, PremierChristianity.com for their website, and go to /free sample if you'd like to get a free sample copy of the latest edition of the magazine. You can find today's interview over at the Profile podcast as well. That's premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. Simon, welcome along to the program today. It's great to have you with me. Arusha International, you've been involved for quite some time, I believe. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yes, so Arusha is an umbrella of 21 organizations around the world, and Arusha International is the organization that links them all together. It's a Christian organization that seeks to demonstrate God's love for creation, and we do practical conservation activities as part of our worship of God. So we're more than just a think tank, although we do theological work, and we do preaching in churches and things like that. But we try and live it out practically on the ground through conservation activities.
That's right. How many countries does Arusha work in, do you know?
So we're formally involved in about 20 countries, but we have informal arrangements through many more. But it's about 20 at the moment.
And when was it founded?
Founded in 1983 by Peter and Miranda Harris, and by another couple, the Batties. And actually, I first heard about it because I was, as a very young person, I went to Greenbelt in 1983, and there was a little stall run by Les and Wendy Batty for Arusha. And I signed up and got on the mailing list then, and was ever since. But I didn't get involved properly until much later.
Yes, and nearly 30 years later, 40, nearly 40 years later, you are, of course, the new executive director. Now, this comes sort of as a bittersweet appointment because, of course, we had the tragic events just over a year ago when Peter and Miranda Harris, as you say, the co-founders of Arusha, along with Chris Naylor, who was the international director, and his wife Susanna, were all involved in a terrible road accident in South Africa. Miranda, Chris and Susanna all died in that. Obviously that must have sent and continues to send really shockwaves through the whole of the Arusha community and Christian conservationism in general. What's happened in the past year as a result of those events?
Goodness, it's hard to know what to say. I would say a few days after the tragedy, when we knew that Chris and Susanna and Miranda were dead, and Peter Harris was fighting for his life, unconscious in a hospital in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. We were due to have an international trustees meeting of Arusha. We obviously couldn't hold that meeting. Everyone was too traumatized, but we instead met at St. Aldate's, the trustees who could make it, Arusha staff, and the Harris and Naylor families bravely came along to that meeting in St. Aldate's, and we just prayed and cried, really. Gradually over time, we sort of got ourselves organized. We held really moving memorial services to Chris and Susanna at their church out in the Cotswolds, and then at St. Aldate's for Miranda in December, and Peter was able to be back and attend that service. It was pretty grueling in some ways, and yet we were also able to give thanks. The finance director of Arusha International, David McKay, who was planning to retire, really sacrificially stepped in to take the helm and run Arusha International during the subsequent year, and has steadied the ship, as it were, and graciously given his time to help the leadership transition. And that resulted in myself quite unexpectedly and without initially planning to do so, to become executive director, just starting on the 1st of December, in fact. And so that's what's happened. I would say that the Arusha family around the world is still grieving, but also moving forward. And we see signs of hope in many places.
Perhaps we'll return to what their contribution has been, obviously, over the decades, and really, yes, what the future of Arusha is in terms of the legacy they've left. But let's go back to the beginning for you, Simon, first of all, which is what we always do on the profile. Did you grow up in a Christian household, or was that something that came to you later on in life?
Later on, really. I mean, I went to a I was brought up in a household that went to church, went to a rather formal church, and I was a choir boy. I was very influenced by scripture lessons, as they were called in prep school in Bournemouth, where we learned all the whole storyline of the Bible, and I loved that very much. So by the time I was 13, I pretty much knew my Bible, even though I wasn't formally taught it in church or at home. I would say the family were to some extent sympathetic. My father had a Jewish background, although, I mean, he was half Jewish, but they had left Judaism completely before the Second World War. So that was my background. It wasn't explicitly Christian in the sense you're meaning, I think.
No. Well, we'll find out how it did become explicitly Christian later on. But obviously, you seem to have had a passion for nature, ornithology in particular, birds. And this was in the context of growing up in a fairly rural part of Dorset, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was very keen on birds, also reptiles and amphibians, well, pretty much everything, really, from very small. Certainly by the time I was six, according to my parents, I was heavily into everything to do with natural history. So, yeah, that was very much part of my life. I received a lot of encouragement from adults around me. My parents proactively put me in touch with people who could teach me more. They very much encouraged this. And then at secondary school, at Camford School in Dorset, I came under the influence of a biology teacher who taught me an enormous amount. And he is still alive, and I'm still communicating with him.
And, well, I mean, not everyone develops this particular passion. What was it, do you think, that made you feel so much that you wanted to get out into nature, and not just to do that, but to document it, to understand it, and ultimately to make sure it was conserved? Because I understand even from a very young age, you were quite taken with the fact that some species were dying out and under threat and so on.
Yes, apparently I was making lists of species threatened with extinction when I was very small and stuff like that. And I was reading books and things like that. I can only assume that this is how God made me, because I don't think my parents initiated it, but they encouraged it once it started. So I can only assume that this is how I was wired.
Yeah, obviously that carried on into further education. Can you describe sort of where that passion took you when it came to you eventually, you know, moving into more sort of academic ways cataloguing and looking at nature and conservation and so on?
Yeah, so when I got to Camford School, this teacher, Tim Hooker, and now long retired, of course, he, in addition to doing formal biology lessons, he ran a natural history society. So he taught us, and there were several of us who were very keen. I wasn't the only one. And so there was a certain amount of peer encouragement as well, a lot of peer encouragement, in fact. And he took us on natural history camps. He taught us pretty much everything, birdsong, how to catch snakes, how to identify which fungi were poisonous and which ones could be eaten. We learned an enormous amount. He now claims that we were teaching him as much as he taught us, but I think he's just being humble, to be honest. We learned an enormous amount of, and that really set me up to look at natural history in a more scientific and a more rigorous way without losing the passion. And then he introduced me to the chimpanzee expert, Jane Goodall, who is well famous person, of course. He was friends with her, and that resulted in my going out to Tanzania in my gap year between school and going to Cambridge. And then I developed a love for Africa and a broader understanding. He also got me and a colleague to go on an expedition to Shetlands as well. That was a little bit earlier. So we were enormously blessed and encouraged and had privileges that frankly weren't available to most people.
Yes, what an extraordinary start to your career, being able to know Jane Goodall and the extraordinary work she does that was, of course, so well known in the media. You went to Cambridge to continue studies, but you not only, you know, bumped into many more people, obviously, and possibility of experiences in terms of biology, but also Christians there. What sort of changed at Cambridge that meant your faith went from something that was obviously there was some awareness of Christianity and, you know, pretty good understanding of the Bible, but obviously it flourished into something more.
Well, I think I was always interested. I always loved the Bible storyline, though I didn't understand the significance of it at the time. I mentioned a teacher in prep school who deeply impressed me. There was another teacher at Camford School, my secondary school, a chemistry teacher, who deeply impressed me by the... by his genuine nature, and he was well known to be a Christian, and that I'm sure encouraged me in the right direction as well. And then when I got to Cambridge, I came across students who were Christians and was deeply impressed by their genuine nature, the fact that they weren't just trying to impress people, they dared to be different, but were human as well. And so I guess I got into a good crowd, you could say. And the woman who was to become my wife much later, Anne, she was part of the same group. She also wasn't a Christian, but was deeply impressed by Christians, became a Christian a few months before I did. And so I think that that's what led to it. I think the years... Before I went to Cambridge were all good preparation to make me well inclined to the gospel of Jesus Christ. But the witness of the people, and to be honest, it was their lives more than what they said that mattered. And that's what led to me making a commitment at the end of my first year at Cambridge.
Interesting. I mean, did you sort of have any struggle putting this newfound faith together with the science that you were obviously studying at the time?
Trying to remember now. I don't think I had huge great struggles, to be honest. I guess I just couldn't see what the problems were. Later on, as society became more aggressively secular, and we had much more in the way of supposedly scientific attacks on faith, then I guess I had to think about it some more. But not really so much during my time at Cambridge. To be honest, there were quite a lot of Christians who were scientists and had no problems being rigorous scientists and also Christians.
You went on to do further work in Africa, didn't you? Can you describe some of the projects you were involved in?
Yeah, I went on to do my PhD field work back in Tanzania. I studied a community of, by a community, I mean, all the birds that existed in the forests of what we now call the Eastern Arc Mountains of Tanzania. This is a whole set of mountain ranges that runs down the eastern side of Tanzania, where there are many species, including bird species, that occur nowhere else in the world. They were very poorly known at the time I went there. I was even involved in the discovery of a new species. And so I studied these birds and their susceptibility to habitat change. And that was my PhD field work. I completed that in 1983, actually the year that Arusha was founded, interestingly enough. And I then started working for BirdLife International and working on the African Bird Red Data Book, which was the first official listing of all the threatened birds in Africa and documenting why they were threatened. So I started that work in 1983. We completed that 2 years later. And in the middle of all of that, I also did field work in Cameroon, looking at threatened bird species in the mountains of Western Cameroon as well. So I did all of that really leading up until 1985.
Yes. When you say you discovered a new species, does that still happen? You know, have we catalogued everything that's out there now, or are we still discovering new things?
Oh, not close to discovering everything. So I think about one new bird species is discovered a year. Birds are the best research group of animals. Mammals, there are many more small mammals are discovered each year. Occasionally, even a large mammal, a new species gets discovered, though that is very seldom now.
I did hear just the other day that a new species of whale has been discovered recently, interestingly. And you'd think, you know, that's not just a little beetle. You know, that's a pretty big item to have thus far gone undiscovered. Yes. But yeah.
Yes, although you do get, it gets complicated because you get what we call species complexes, which are a name we put on a group of animals or plants that we know to be more than one species, but to do the rigorous work to separate it out into its component parts takes a long time, and that's been going on with whales. But to give you another example, amphibians, which is a group I work on, probably around 150 new species get discovered a year.
Gosh,
that's a lot of species.
What I mean, as a Christian, sort of how do you approach that? Do you just see this as God's, you know, abundance, God's creativity? What's the way that you think of that as a Christian?
I think it is that, but it also shows that creation, as we call it, as Christians we call it, is much more complicated and diverse than we ever imagined. So what God has brought into being, I believe, obviously through not through a 7-day process, but through a much larger and more complex process that we call evolution, is far more complicated. And I think that says something, you know, it's hard to understand what God has made. It's very hard to understand. We're gradually doing it. That's the process of science. And it says something about the nature of God. I guess that he himself is a much more complex than wonderful than we realize most of the time.
Obviously, when you've been out in the field doing the work, you've been there, you know, as a scientist to do the research. But have you had those moments, I don't know, in Africa or other parts of the world where you've just had a sense of the awesomeness of creation that have spoken to you, perhaps beyond just the, you know, the science that you're doing, but of the God behind the science?
I think that's a, to be honest, I think that's a regular experience for all people who work in nature, whether they have a faith or not. You have that sense of wonder. Mm. And I realize that points to the creator. But I think every biologist knows that. And it's something that drives us on, and it's not just a dry science. It's driven by a passion. In the chapter I wrote in the book that Sam Berry edited in Real Scientist, Real Faith, I point to an experience I had on Mount Oku in Cameroon, where I just felt the trees of the field clapping their hands in the sense of Isaiah 55 as I sat on top of a mountain peak one day. But I think that sense of wonder never leaves the scientist who studies nature, whether or not they say they have faith.
Yes. You say that it was really through meeting Peter and Miranda Harris, and who obviously were the founders of Arusha, that you started to integrate more your Christian faith with the sense of actually the way that God has, you know, created and given us charge to look after that creation, that Christianity isn't simply about getting souls to heaven, but it's about something much bigger than that. Do you want to sort of describe that journey you went on?
So I would say that I always saw my conservation work as a calling in some loose sense. I've always felt that the jobs I've done have been callings. But what I came to realize as I got more involved in Arusha was that the Bible spoke much more to caring for creation as being part of our worship of God than I had realized. So what happened is when I was working for IUCN, which is the International Union for Conservation of Nature, which is the umbrella body of nature conservation, when I was working for them in Geneva in 1999, I was phoned up by the person who had recently become chair of the board of Arusha International and asked if I would be interested in meeting Peter Miranda Harris. Of course, I knew who they were because I was a member of Arusha. I was a passive member. And so and my wife, Anne, and I, we were readily, enthusiastically agreed to meet Peter and Miranda. And that was the beginning of a journey for us where we started to see God's work and the work of Christ in that much broader sense of not only saving humanity, but also renewing all of creation, in the sense you find in Romans chapter 8. Hadn't really grasped that fully at that time. And of course, it only started to dawn on us slowly. And so now I see conservation work as part of worship in a way that I hadn't seen before.
There is, if you like, sometimes a felt tension between some forms of Christianity and environmentalism and conservation work. Christians who say, well, it's all going to burn anyway. God's going to, you know, God's going to take us all away. This earth will be no more. So what's the point of trying to conserve? And, you know, Jesus will return and we won't need to worry about all this stuff. at some point?
So it's interesting. So as a family, we lived in Washington, D.C. from 2001 to 2006. So we and we worshipped at a Presbyterian church there. And that obviously exposed us to a much more, if you like, right-wing, politically right-wing form of Christianity than we'd ever encountered in Switzerland or in where we were living or in the UK. That said, I don't think anyone has ever said to me, it's all going to burn, therefore we don't need to care. No doubt there are people out there who believe that, and you sometimes hear people say that. But I have to say, no one has ever said that to me. And I've come across many politically conservative and politically liberal Christians who are passionate about conservation. Yes, I have sadly seen in recent years some more politicized forms of Christianity get into climate change denying and things like that, which is sad to see. But I personally have not ever had anyone come to me and say, it's all going to burn, therefore we say, you know, therefore we don't need to do anything.
Perhaps. I mean, but there is a strain within certain, as you say, forms of Christianity that are skeptical, let's say, of climate change claims. There was a quote from a sermon by John MacArthur that was circulated quite widely a couple of months ago, though I'm not sure exactly when the sermon was preached, but in which he said these words: God intended us to use this planet, to fill this planet for the benefit of man. Never was it intended to be a permanent planet. It is a disposable planet. Christians ought to know that. I mean, obviously you haven't got the full context for that quote, but what's your sort of response to that kind of a way of thinking about the planet?
So to my understanding, and I'm not a theologian, I'm a scientist, I'm not a theologian, but to my understanding, the New Testament talks about the renewal of creation. And it will obviously go through, and we are putting it through, some pretty painful times in which there is a lot of death in this planet, not just human death and misery, but death of species, death of ecosystems, poison plastics, climate change, all the rest. And this may or may not be judgment. That's beyond my pay grade to know, as not being a theologian, to say. But well, I think what is clear is from passages like 1 Corinthians 15 is that creation will be renewed, and it's not some ethereal out of the body experiences is what eternal life is going to be made, but it's going to be physical, clearly in a different sense from the way we experience physical things, but nonetheless physical. And I don't know the context of that quote, but I think if we take the fact that creation is going to be changed and renewed as a license to destroy it, I say we are not glorifying God in doing that, and we are not witnessing to Christ as a lover of his creation, and I think we are not portraying Christ in a good light to non-Christians if we behave like that.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley, in conversation with Dr. Simon Stewart, the new executive director of Arosha International. And we'll be back very shortly.
Do you want to stay informed on the best of what's happening in the UK church today? Premier Christianity magazine is for you. The UK's leading Christian magazine is published every month and features interviews with Christian leaders, in-depth reporting, reviews, columnists, and loads more. And best of all, you can try it for free. Head to our website now to request the latest edition worth £5.95, completely free of charge.
Visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. And The Profile is brought to you in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine. If you'd like to get a free sample copy of the latest edition of the mag, do go to their website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. Always interesting interviews that you'll find in the magazine, and always interesting interviews here on The Profile week by week on Premier Christian Radio and via our podcast as well. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Simon Stewart, the new executive director of Arosha International, which is really the major Christian conservation creation charity globally. We've talked about your background researching conservation, ecology, and so on, Simon. Where do we stand now? If you could paint a picture for us of the sorts of threats that currently exist towards biodiversity, various animal species in the world, what's your broad brush picture of that?
Okay, that's a big question. So humanity is living massively out of balance with the planet, and the demands we're making of it are completely unsustainable. And in particular, three demands we make of the planet: our demand for food, our demand for water, and our demand for energy are all out of balance. And those over demands, some of which are caused by wastefulness, in fact, a lot caused by wastefulness, are driving a whole set of crises that we now face. So we have a crisis of inequity and poverty in the world. We have a crisis of climate change. We have a crisis of disease, not just affecting humans, by the way. There are other pandemics out there. And we have a crisis of biodiversity loss, as we call it, extinction, and the loss of nature, and others we could come up with. And these are basically driven by humanity demanding too much, too carelessly. And the result of that, when we look at biodiversity loss, is we have rates of extinction that are at least 1,000 times higher than we experienced in the geological record. And we now have 40% of amphibians globally threatened, 26% of mammals, 14% of birds, which is the least threatened group, but still 14%, 33% of corals, and many others. And that is because of our impact on the planet.
We hear a lot about this, and obviously before the pandemic became the big news story globally, we were regularly hearing about groups like Extinction Rebellion making very visible protests, often controversial protests, but equally many significant characters. David Attenborough, of course, really sees his legacy in his final years as warning through various documentaries and other means about the danger that we face, not just to the survival of various animal species and plant species in the world, but humans themselves. I mean, do you see that as being a sort of, you know, a possibility that humans themselves could be driven to the edge of extinction if things carry on as they are?
I don't know about that. Predicting exactly what's going to happen is tricky. Clearly, we are creating inhospitable conditions across the world in which many people are going to suffer. We're changing the climate, which could be very serious for people. But, you know, so many unpredictable things happen that to say that species, humans will go extinct and that's how God's judgment will take place or whatever, I'm not certain I can say that. What I can say is the way we're behaving is disrespectful of our fellow human beings. It's disrespectful of the wonderful animals and plants and fungi and things that we've been given the privilege of sharing this planet with. And it's most importantly, dishonoring of God. And so that's what I can say. And it's leading in a bad direction, carrying on behaving as we are. I can say that with confidence. Both the science and the theology point in that that direction. And we as Christians have to be in front in terms of really taking a lead and saying we must respect each other and the non-human creation in a way that honors God.
Do you think we've time to turn the tide? I mean, we often hear we're on the brink. There's only X amount of years before we can no longer turn the tide on global warming and so on. A lot of people almost, I think, have an attitude that, well, it's going to happen. What's your view on that?
Lots of views. Well, first of all, as Christians, we have to do it because it's the right thing to do, even if there isn't time. Mm. There isn't time isn't a good excuse, because the faithful thing to do is to honor God. And we should act to do the right thing for creation, whether or not there is time. So that would be my first response. Secondly, the climate change, which is only one of the big threats facing the challenge, facing the planet. The big challenge here is that the longer we delay, the more we have to do and the more time we need to do to rectify it. So the climate change challenge is particularly urgent, and we absolutely cannot delay. And so Greta Thunberg, some people might see her as extreme, but actually she's right. She is right. We absolutely have to act, because the time is now. It is not tomorrow. That said, the driver of extinction, the biggest driver of extinction right now, probably isn't climate change. It is probably habitat loss driven by agriculture, at least for terrestrial extinction. Mm. And it is also unsustainable demand for fresh water is also driving extinction in freshwater habitats. So one of my big beefs that I put out there is we are so focused on climate change now, and that is great, that we are forgetting the other drivers of unsustainability and biodiversity loss in the planet. So one of the big problems we have now is a general belief that hydroelectric power is green. It is not green, except in very rare circumstances. It is the biggest driver of freshwater extinction out there, probably, or at least one of them. Mm. And so it's fantastic that the UK have stopped investing in funding overseas carbon-based energy. But the same has to apply for hydroelectric as well. So we have to look at things much more broadly. We must include climate change in that. It is especially urgent, but we have to look at all the other threats as well.
The problem, of course, is that, like so many things, these things become politicized, don't they? And a lot of people, I think, have decided that, well, environmentalism, conservation issues and so on, they're just in the sort of the radical left wing, you know, bucket, and that's, you know, and it's probably all overblown, and you know, it's just all those Greta Thunbergs and Extinction Rebellion extremists that I mean, is there a problem there that in a way those issues have somehow been now associated with a particular political stance? What do you think?
Yes, I think it is very unfortunate if conservation becomes aligned to one political ideology. It's actually good that the current UK government, with some people who I think would be seen as very definitely right-wing, have advanced a conservation agenda very strongly. So Zach Goldsmith, for example, has in this government pushed a strong conservation agenda, and he is definitely not of the same political persuasion as some other strong conservationists, and that is healthy. That's what I want to see. I want to see conservation not in just one political camp. I want to see it across the political spectrum. And I think if we look at the political parties in the UK, frankly, none of them can really show off in terms of their historical record on conservation. They all come across as pretty weak, and they all have to get much, much stronger in this, and they all have to advance a strong conservation agenda that is not just a climate change agenda. It has to be a comprehensive conservation agenda that must include climate change. So that's what I would like to see.
Yes. The problem, I suppose, I don't know whether you agree with this, but maybe comes ultimately down to the human heart. We're all pretty selfish, frankly, at the end of the day, and we do tend to prioritize our own needs, and we don't tend to look at the broad impact that we have. We are able now more than ever, because of people like yourself and the research you do, to see what that impact is. But the question is, are we willing to change the way we live and, you know, the inconveniences that will bring into our life? Because obviously that means changing the way we act and so on. That's the battle, I suppose, at the end of the day, isn't it? How much we're willing to do to see these issues changed.
Yeah, that's true. And we're all to blame on this, of course, and our lifestyles. But what are the consequences of not doing it? So are we going to take responsible decisions now that might include some sacrifice, or are we going to be forced into even more radical sacrifices down the road? Look at the pandemic. It's forced us to make sacrifices that we had no intention of making, because and the pandemic a lot of disease in the world has come from poor environmental management and poor treatment of animals, put it bluntly.
There are, of course, you say quite rightly, Christians should be at the forefront of responding, and because of their, you know, belief in a good world that God has made and the care he's given us to take care of it, pushing for these issues. And yet, at least the way it often reads in the media sometimes, it almost seems the opposite, you know, that very often Christians seem to be among the most likely to be skeptical, for instance, of climate change. I know that's not the only issue out there. But there does seem to be, as I say, because the issues have become politicized, there are significant blocks who are pushing back and saying, well, hang on a minute, how do we know that that humans are having this impact? Climate has historically changed over the eons. They may cast skepticism on the idea that humans are having, in fact, the impact that many people say they are. What's your response to that? I'm not expecting you to sort of go into the technical aspects of this, but it's a significant number, in my experience, of Christians who do question the scientific narrative in this regard. What's your response to that?
I would say, if there are any Christians listening to this broadcast that are doubting the science, then step number one is you must always look at science through peer-reviewed science and not through sources that are biased, politically biased. And if you want dependable, rigorous explanation of the science on climate change coming from a Christian, then the place to turn to is Catherine Hayhoe. And her work as a leading climate scientist, who is an evangelical Christian, the wife of a pastor in Texas. And go to her website, Catherine Hayhoe, and read some of the stuff she's put out there. That is dependable, is important. I'd say something else as well, and that is, these issues are in the end about life and death. If we continue to ignore climate change and ignore other environmental problems, or not do enough, because I think it's no longer the case that we're ignoring it, it's the case now is that we're not doing enough, then people are going to die. Disadvantaged people are going to die. People living in much more difficult situations than we are. So this is not something to play around with. This is now serious. And it's just like if a large number of people in this country decide not to get vaccinated against COVID-19 because they've been persuaded by unscientific anti-vaxxers, they put other people's lives at risk by doing that. I'm afraid climate deniers are doing the same. This is not funny anymore. This is not something for armchair debates. This is serious. And Christians really need to step up their game on this. Please visit Catherine Hayhoe's website.
Of course, there's Arosha itself, where you can find out more about the work that the organization you've recently stepped up to lead is doing. What are some of the sort of practical ways? I mean, often we can look at these huge world-changing issues and feel, what possible difference can I make? What difference can Christians make when they get involved with the work that Arosha does? What's the sort of on-the-ground things that can make a practical difference in their own locality?
Oh, but there's so many things that can be done. One thing you might want to do is join Arosha UK. I think we have a UK audience here, so I'm now running Arosha International, but we also have Arosha UK, contact them and find out what can be done. Arosha UK runs the Eco Church program, so that's one thing you can do. And they've also got a new program on Partners in Action, which is looking about what you can do in your own institution or your own setting. So those are very good things to do. And there's a lot of material and resources on the Arosha website. There are books that have been written by people like Dave Booklis that give you very practical ideas. So there are plenty of resources on the Arosha website, Arosha UK and Arosha International and elsewhere. Try and find other like-minded Christians. There are an increasing number of us in the churches.
Yes, arosha.org is the place to go, and that wherever you're listening in the world, perhaps to the podcast, you can actually find links to your nearest organization that's going to be working on these issues. You were recently honored yourself, Simon, with the Blue Planet Award. Tell us what that is.
The Blue Planet Prize is a prize that two are given out each year, and it's a prize that is awarded by the Asahi Glass Foundation, which is a Japanese foundation. And it's a prize for the people working on the interface of science and environmental issues. So I'm one of the two winners this year. So it's been a great honor for me. And I've been able in some of the interviews to mention my Christian faith. It's obviously not a Christian prize in any sense. I'm hoping to be able to use some of the prize to advance Arosha's work as well. So that's what it is.
I mean, what would you say, you know, we've only had really a brief idea of of what your research is involved in the course of this interview. But what would you say are some of the fun, you know, the most important contributions that have been made? And don't be modest here regarding the way that you've been able to catalogue and look at, you know, various aspects of conservation, some of the threats to various species around the world.
Well, I got the prize for two pieces of work. One was the work to develop the system by which IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, for which I used to work, measures the extinction risk of a species. And that's what we call the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. So the lead scientist on that work was the late Professor Dame Georgina Mace, who passed away this last September, very sadly. And she was the lead scientist on it. And I was the staff person at IUCN who supported Georgina. And I did the sort of backup political and negotiating work to get the scientific work through the system. She was the one who kept me scientifically honest. And I was the one working to make sure that the scientific advances that she and her colleagues were working on could get through, could be adopted by the conservation movement broadly. And between us, we succeeded. And now we have over 120,000 species around the world assessed by that system. And that is being used to channel where money goes for conservation. It's being used to make sure that money from governments and the corporate sector doesn't damage nature in the wrong way. It's being used in to drive scientific research in all sorts of ways. So that's the first thing that I received the prize for. The second thing was my work on the amphibian crisis. So amphibians are frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, and a few other things. And the work I did in the early 2000s was to look at the amphibian crisis and to try and understand why these species, well, how threatened they were, where they were most threatened, and what was driving the threats. And that's where we demonstrated how severe amphibian disease is to amphibians. So we're panicking because of a pandemic, right, among humans. But amphibians have had a pandemic going on since the 1980s. And it's affecting hundreds, if not thousands, of species. It's a fungal pandemic rather than a viral pandemic. And so I led the work on that. Had over 500 scientists involved. And that's the other reason why I received the prize.
Well, congratulations on the prize, albeit work that obviously it reminds us again of some of the crisis issues that exist in nature. And given that you've got such a front row seat to so many of these concerns, do you remain optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Where do you see God at work in all of this? How do you kind of, you know, put this all together as a Christian in terms of believing ultimately that somehow God is in control and that God's purposes will be worked out eventually?
It's always so hard, isn't it, to look at something and say that was God, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I think that is sometimes tricky. What I can tell you is that many Christians working in conservation feel encouraged by God in their work, feel him close, and know that we're honoring him in that. So in that sense, yes, I can tell you that. I guess that isn't that it would probably be very similar to what a Christian working in the medical profession feels.
Mm.
I can also tell you that without the current conservation effort, even though things are getting worse in the world. I can tell you that without the current conservation effort, things would be much worse than they are now. I was involved in a team that did some research a few years ago where we looked at the world's ungulates. That's things like cattle and deer and goats and things like that. All the wild species, and we looked at what would have happened to those species if we'd stopped all conservation measures in 1996. It was a thought experiment. Mm-hmm. And over a 12-year period from 1996 and up until 2008, we found out that on the IUCN Red List, those species, their status would have been 8 times worse had it not been for conservation action that took place in that 12-year period. Another way of putting that is the conservation that was done was incredibly effective. Mm. There simply wasn't enough of it.
Right.
And so the little bit we did really made a big difference. It slowed the rate of decline of these species overall, and it brought about a recovery of some of them. So that to me is also a sign of hope.
Hmm.
We can do things.
A year on from the very tragic death of Miranda Harris and Chris and Susanna Naylor, what do you hope will be the legacy as we enter 2021 for Christians who want to continue the work that they began?
Miranda Harris was someone who demonstrated God's love to people in a very practical way. If you're ever in a social gathering and Miranda was there, you would see her in some corner in deep conversation with somebody, and you could be sure that conversation would have a life-changing experience on the person being spoken to. She did that time and time and time again, and after she died, so many of those stories have come out, and she allowed herself to be used by God to help all sorts of people in that sort of way. Chris and Susanna Naylor, they led for many years Arosha's work in the Bekaa Valley in the Netherlands. They work in the Lebanon. That was difficult work. Sort of obvious, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that work continues long after they left it. That flickering light of Christian engagement in conservation in the Middle East that Chris and Susanna led continues. They chose to do the difficult thing, not the spectacular thing. It was God honoring, and that continues. And I believe that flickering flame will continue to burn. And it, in some senses, looks unspectacular, but in another sense, is very significant. And as we know from countless stories in the Bible, that's how God works, isn't it?
Mm. Well, let's hope and pray that more people take up the mantle and the example that they have left as a legacy to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose ultimately, do you find yourself optimistic that Christians will do this, that we will see change in our lifetime?
Yeah, I think I am optimistic about that one. I think there is a change at foot. I think, especially among young Christians,
mm-hmm.
they nearly always want to see these sorts of changes. And of course, the future is in the young. I think we haven't got enough of the theological teaching that I've been blessed to receive in my very privileged life. We haven't seen that spread through the grassroots in the churches enough, anything like enough around the world. It's probably happened more in the UK than most other countries. But we need to see much more of that. Mm. And I would like to see Arusha and other organizations really promote that at the grassroots level among ordinary Christians about how we look at the Bible and see our responsibility to creation come out from the pages of the Bible. And the more that is done, the more we're going to see Christians behave differently. But we're already seeing it starting to happen.
If you want to find out more about the work of Arusha, go to arusha.org. It's been an absolute delight to talk to you, Simon, about your role, your new role as the executive director of Arusha International. But as you said, chapters, as it were, exist all over the world that people can get involved in. All the very best for 2021 as you step into this new adventure. And our prayers and blessings go with you. So thank you for being with me on The Profile today.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. If you'd like to listen back to today's show, do check out our podcast at premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. And don't forget to get hold of your sample copy of Premier Christianity magazine as well by going to their website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. For the moment, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker.
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%, vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.